This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with Frank Campbell. For 18 years, he was head of the Crisis Intervention Center in Baton Rouge. He's a forensic suicidologist noted nationally for his work, and he'll talk about the increase in suicides, not only the prominent ones that we've read and heard about lately, Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, but suicide is on the increase in a dramatic way all across the country in the 21st century. Also on the show today, George Sells, the veteran anchorman for WAFB Channel 9. For 24 years, he shared the anchor desk with Donna Britt, who tonight provides the last newscast of her long and storied career. And we'll talk with George Sells about the legacy of the remarkable Donna Britt. And Dr. Adam Cox, his book is Cracking the Boy Code. Now the news on WRKN. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, wherever you are. And if you're in Baton Rouge, you can save a few digits by dialing 297-5633. You can always send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Dr. Frank Campbell. For 18 years, he was the director of the Crisis Intervention Center here in Baton Rouge. He is a nationally regarded forensic suicidologist, and suicide is, again, a big topic in our country based on the high-profile deaths in recent days of Kate Spade and of Anthony Bourdain. But the annual U.S. suicide rate has increased by 24% in the 21st century, according to the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics. The annual age-adjusted suicide rate is 13.3 per 100,000 individuals. That's each year. Men die by suicide 3.5 times more than women, but women attempt suicide 2 times more often than do men. On average, there are 121 suicides today a day, with white males accounting for 7 of the 10 suicides reported, and a firearm is used in about half of the cases. The rate of suicide is highest in middle age, and white men in particular. 877-217-5757, a sensitive topic, but an important one. And Frank Campbell, you've been wrestling with this for many years. Why are more people taking their lives per capita now than in previous times?
Well, Jim, I think that it's a very complex question, of course. This is a paradoxical cause of death where there's often a more simple solution than we realize, but it's in a very complicated field of study that's in America only about 52 years old, and I've been associated with the field about 32 years. So I was fortunate to have mentors early on that taught me different ways to think about suicide. My best answer to when people say, why does this happen, is to say that it, first of all, should be looked at one-on-one. It shouldn't be aggregated to large numbers because you lose a lot of the actual information that way. So when I think about an individual dying, I see it as a failure to cope with a self-defined crisis. And that might mean that up until that point, that person was able to cope with many different issues in their life. But for some reason, vulnerability or access to method or means, perhaps alcohol or drugs on board, they may have not been able to sustain life at that moment.
Well, it's an individual choice, as we know, and there are all kinds of variables. But there are some fascinating numbers when you look at the CDC's breakdown. Suicide, for example, in the state of Wyoming is four times higher than it is in the state of New York. Now, most people would think probably that if you lived in New York, New York City in particular, you would be under a lot more stress than you would be in Laramie, Wyoming, but it's four times higher in Wyoming. Those kinds of variables are hard to fathom. How does that happen?
It's been true, though, for as long as they've recorded these death certificates, that the big sky states have had the higher rates of suicide. And I think that the assumptions always are that the East Coast or the West Coast or highly populated cities are going to be more represented. But in reality, it could be that one protective factor is participation in a robust community and also surrounded by lots of resources. You look at those big sky states, there's only one state in the last 18 years that has not had an increase in suicide rate, and that's Nevada. Nevada was number one for as long as we recorded these numbers, but in the last 18 years, because of their suicide prevention approach and their statewide commitment, they're the only state out of the union that has not had an increase in suicide during the same time period. So many people are beginning to recognize that you can make a difference in suicide rates, but it has to be a unified approach. Louisiana does have an active suicide prevention committee, and lots of folks work diligently on there. I think Danita LeBlanc's been the head of that as long as it's been around, and we are making a difference in Louisiana, but we are above the national average for the first time in a while.
I'm looking at the numbers from 2016. Louisiana does have a higher per capita rate than the national average, but according to this report, 30th in the country. And the reason why you could have a higher rate and rank 30th out of 50 states is because it's the big states that have the low suicide rates. Texas is 40th, for example. California is 45th, and then New York is 49th, and New Jersey is number 50. New Jersey is the place where people are least likely to take their lives, 7.2, about half the rate of Louisiana. And it is apparent that people who live in the most populous states are less likely to commit suicide than people who live in these sparse states. The top states for suicide: Montana, Alaska, Wyoming, New Mexico, Utah, Idaho, Nevada. So these are very small states relative to the rest of the country.
Well, that's true. And if you think about living in a very isolated area, look at Nevada. 97% of their population live in Las Vegas. And having been out there and done training over the state, I can tell you that resources can be very far apart in some of the more rural areas. And this is true in Texas as well. So what we see is suicide tends to show up more in places where resources, including just neighbors, are further away. And I think that's a part of the coping stool. The four-legged stool of coping talks about participation in a supportive community. It's hard to have that when you live far away from resources or individuals that might just knock on your door and inquire. I often say when I give talks that in the South we used to build porches on our homes and put rocking chairs in on them, and we used to sit in them at the end of the day and talk to each other. Today we chain them together so they won't get stolen, and we're inside isolated. I think that has a lot of expectation around suicide, that when we isolate and withdraw, it's much easier to ruminate and convince yourself that suicide is a solution. It's faulty thinking, in my opinion, but it's easier to do when you have no one but yourself there as a sounding board.
877-217-5757 is your number for Dr. Frank Campbell, a renowned forensic suicidologist. He spent almost two decades as head of the Crisis Intervention Center here in Baton Rouge. And services, of course, are important for a community. And through the years, we have interviewed people associated with the phone. And I understand there's a big change regarding that service in our community.
Well, phone services throughout the United States have begun consolidating in order to stay alive. Unfortunately, crisis centers show the most benefit to have in a community, but funding for them has often been challenging because of the competition, if you will, for donor dollars today is quite spread out against other social issues as well. But the phone is still operational here in East Baton Rouge Parish. The Crisis Center Board of Directors has worked diligently with the Baton Rouge Area Foundation to create a safe transition, and those programs are operating here in Baton Rouge but supervised by a program out of New Orleans via Link and a potential agency here that will have a bigger footprint, the Bridge for Hope program.
How is the rate here in Baton Rouge, in the city where you and I are reporting from?
Well, unfortunately, we don't establish rates of suicide in populations this size because no one year makes a rate and no one year makes a trend. But we have a wonderful coroner, Dr. Bo Clark, who produces a report, an annual report every year, and he looks at causes of death, And I can tell you that the most recent publication he's put out, which is 2017, way ahead of the CDC, suggests that we had an uptick in body count. So not rate, but the number of deaths went to 58, I think, in 2017 over maybe 49 or 46 two years before. So there's been a slight increase, and part of that is probably because of good forensics being done and a willingness to declare a rate of suicide or a death by suicide, rather, than an ambiguous death like undetermined, which is also a difficult challenge today with all the opioid overdoses mm-hmm. we have.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to ask you, and a listener has beat me to the punch. With these opioid deaths, how does one determine whether it's an accidental death or a suicide?
Well, all ambiguous deaths leave the family and the friends questioning this. I think most coroners today are reluctant to check the box suicide unless they have fairly clear forensic evidence. There was a time when we looked at behavior psychologically, we wondered about the intent of the behavior. And for many people, the overdose is not an intended death. It's accidental, or it's a bad mix of chemicals in their body, or they're more vulnerable at that time. A cause of death that's used in the United Kingdom more often for these deaths is called death by misadventure. And I think it actually captures a different category that might be at some point useful in determining these deaths. Without knowing the intent of the behavior, it's hard to rule that a suicide.
877-217-5757 is your number for Dr. Frank Campbell. We'll be going to the phone lines in just a bit. Attempted suicide rates for lesbian, gay, transgender, and questioning youth and adults in the U.S. are 3 times higher than the national average, and U.S. Army report indicates military veterans have double the suicide rate of non-veterans. We're back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757 for Dr. Frank Campbell, who's with us. George Sells will be with us shortly to talk about the farewell tonight of Donna Britt on WAFB after almost 40 years on the anchor desk. 877-217-5757 is your number for Dr. Frank Campbell. Now, a question from a listener about ethnic groups. Minority groups actually commit suicide at a lesser rate than do whites, don't they?
Well, they die by suicide at a slower rate.
Please turn this. Go ahead.
Tend to not use the word commit anymore. It's an archaic term in which suicide was illegal. So people don't commit cancer, and they die by suicide just like they die by cancer. So when you look at ethnicity, black females would have the lowest rate of suicide in the United States, and I've often thought it would have been helpful for us to study what are the protective factors that black females incorporate in their life to stay safe from suicide. Unfortunately, all demographics seem to be experiencing increases at this time.
But it is a reality that black people commit suicide at a far lesser rate than do whites.
I'm going to keep saying die by suicide. I want to take that commit out of that sentence.
Well, answer my question.
Yeah.
Why do black people not take their lives
Is black
perhaps black people tend to be more spiritual than the rest of the country as a whole? Is that part of it, perhaps?
It's possible. Certainly blacks often identify their community as their faith community. However, black young males have had a higher rate of suicide now for some time.
Not nearly as close as white males.
No way near. Yeah.
Not
white
nearly.
White males around the planet are going to have the higher rates of suicide. Access to method can't be ruled out. We know that access to means is high for all individuals in America. The reversibility of the method is more important to me. When it comes to ethnicity, though, Jim, we only are just now having good data from black suicidologists that are beginning to identify protective factors.
David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on with Dr. Frank Campbell.
Good morning, gentlemen. There's an article in the New York Times science section. In order to ward off depression, it helps a great deal to stay in shape and exercise. So to be physically fit can help possibly prevent some suicides. And may I give out the number of the National Suicide Hotline?
Sure.
I think it's 1-800-273-TALK. 1-800-273-TALK. And, you know, I've had a lot of rough moments in my life. I lost my eyesight. I lost everything in Katrina. I've had huge financial setbacks, but never for a second did I ever think of committing suicide. I know everybody's different and people have a different body chemistry, but life is such a precious gift, and I'm doing very well right now. I've recovered, and I have a wonderful life in Atlanta, and I just want to tell people, whatever it takes, reach down and just fight off whatever feelings you have, because my dear mother would say there's an answer to every, there's a solution to every problem.
All right. Thank you, David, in Atlanta. Frank?
Well, David's right about the National Lifeline number and the benefits of exercise. Depression is connected to a percentage of suicide, although I think we don't often talk about the opposite fact. So even though a large number of people who die by suicide might be clinically depressed, 90% of people with clinical depression will never take their life. So we have to make sure that we flip the statistic and really become more informed rather than always associate suicide with depression or even mental illness for that problem. It's a public health problem.
John Nosaka is calling in. He is Director of Training and Emergency Preparedness for the Capital Area Human Services. And, John, you, like Frank, are involved with this on a regular basis. What services does Capital Area Human Services provide along these lines?
Well, overall, hey, Frank, good morning.
Good morning, John.
And Jim, good morning. Overall, Capital Area handles the mental health, substance abuse, and developmental disability services for this region, for East Baton Rouge parishes and the surrounding parishes. And when it comes to helping people with depression and people who are at risk for suicide, we have a variety of services, individual and group outpatient services. We have psychiatrists, nurses, social workers, and counselors that work here. We have groups for substance abuse. We have a walk-in system where people don't have to wait, which I think is particularly helpful in a community where sometimes it could take 2 and 3 months for people to be able to get professional help. Over here, we're prepared to take people as a walk-in and get them started in their process when they're ready.
All right. If you could stay on the line, John, in our remaining moments with you and Dr. Frank Campbell, it'd be interesting to get your take as well on this. Listener asks about suicide being associated with tough economic times. Is that a factor as well?
Well, the history of depression was where we first really started studying suicide rates in America and began to compare those. Tough economic times have always been a peak, if you will, in suicide rates. But the problem with the peaks is it takes our view off the whole horizon. The reality is that people die every day at an alarming rate, probably 2.5 times that of homicide in our country. And we don't consider it the public health problem that it is. Now, John has pointed to, and Dr. Jan Kosofsky and her whole staff have done an excellent job of explaining why the suicide rates in East Baton Rouge Parish might be lower than in other parishes. And next week I'll be doing a training down in Houma for law enforcement officers that are taking an entire week to look at suicide, 40 hours of training. That's what I really believe helps us the most, those frontline responders who have access.
All right, John, what about people who are having economic challenges? Does that create the kind of stress that might be associated with somebody who might consider taking their life?
I think it can. You know, Frank's the expert, so I would defer to him, of course. But I think economic stress is just one of a number of different stresses that people can experience. The question for me is, what are the coping skills that that person normally employs? And is there some reason why their usual coping skills aren't helping them in this situation? And whether it's economic, it's work, it's family, it's school, it's social, it's whatever stress they're experiencing, how did they used to cope before, and why is that not enough now? That's the question I want to ask.
877-217-5757, and a listener notes that the United States has a higher suicide rate than other countries. Is that correct?
It's about in the middle of all those that report death rates. There are some countries that don't report suicide as a death rate. When I was in Cuba several times, although they claim there are no suicides there, I worked with several families that experienced multi generational suicide. So we know that the data is corrupted to some level. And I just want to echo what John's saying here. I think the analogy that might be more helpful is to imagine a camel with, instead of a load of straw on their back, they have a load of bricks. And these bricks might be each of these risk factors that get often pointed to as a contributor. And that's all they can be, is a contributor. The reality is we often talk about the last brick that fell on the camel's back that broke their back. The reality is if we could have been unloading those bricks all along, that brick would have had no more significant impact than the ones that preceded it. I think that's often what people do. And we talk about financial benefits. We're talking about two high celebrity people with financial benefit. Right. And they died.
Hold tight. Carrie in Sanama has been waiting, and I want to get Carrie in before we part company with Frank and John. Carrie, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to just reiterate something that Dr. Campbell was talking about with the coping skills. I've known Dr. Campbell for years. I'm a survivor of suicide. I lost my dad to suicide when I was 19 years old. And a combination is, you know, oftentimes we're told, or whenever we talk about the reason someone might have died by suicide, he was just talking about the bricks. You focus on that last one, and very often it's a culmination of events and experiences that lead someone to the point where they feel like, in their faulty thinking at that moment, that there's no other way out, that there's no way that their life could change or get better. You know, that sense of hopelessness in a moment is all it takes for someone to die by suicide.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing your story, Carrie. We'll spend a few more minutes with Frank Campbell and John Nasaka, your number 877-217-5757, and then we hear from the Venerable George Sells. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're going to hear from George Sells in just a moment, a longtime anchorman for WAFB Channel 9, 1988 to 2012. He was on the desk with Donna Britt, who will be delivering her last newscast tonight. We'll talk with George Sells about the remarkable career of his partner, Donna Britt. 877-217-5757 as we wrap up the discussion about suicide in the U.S. and in Louisiana with Dr. Frank Campbell, who for 18 years was head of the Crisis Intervention Center, and John Nosaka, who is involved with Capital Area Human Services. And for those who have an inquiry about your services in particular, John at the Capital Area Human Services. Let me see if I can get him out. And Allie, having a bit of a... There we go. We've got John online again. John, what about the ability to contact your group and get help when people are obviously in need of talking with someone?
Well, first off, let me give you our direct number. It's 225-925-1906. That's 225-925-1906. And if somebody is experiencing pain or the symptoms of mental illness, and they want to, even if they don't already know that they need professional help, they just want to maybe just start having that conversation, please give us a call. And we serve all of the, that's East Baton Rouge Parish, and then going in a circle, Ascension, Iberville, West Baton Rouge, Pointe-Coupee, West Feliciana, and East Feliciana. And we have locations in North Baton Rouge at the Margaret Dumas Mental Health Center. We have a location down in Gonzales at Gonzales Mental Health. And then we have satellite programs in all of those other parishes.
All right. And Frank Campbell, you're no longer directly affiliated with the Crisis Intervention Center, but there is help for people who are in need.
Absolutely. And the National Suicide Hotline can be reached, but it... By telephonics today, that gets rerouted right back here to our community and is answered by the staff at the phone. Or you can call 924-3900 directly.
924-3900.
Right. Outside. I just want to say George Sells was on the board of the Crisis Center, so it's a very friendly neighborhood here this morning.
Well, and you segue well. Thank you very much, Frank Campbell, and thank you, John Nasaka. George Sells is here, and he's here to talk about Donna Britt, who will be delivering her final newscast, and she actually started at WAFB before you did. You were together on air from 1988 to 2012, quite often having the highest ratings of any station in the country. And George Sells, it is a night that for those of us who have watched Donna through the years, it is certainly it's a sad time.
Sad time, and especially sad because of something she told me about 4 weeks ago. She was going to try to work until, believe it or not, until next March. But she also told me that she was not going to embarrass herself or the station if the ALS began to affect her work badly enough that viewers could see it. And I saw her newscast a week ago Tuesday, and for a professional, it was obvious that it really was bad. For the average viewer, it wasn't. But I said, I'll bet you she's going to go in tomorrow morning and pull the plug. And she did. But she wanted to keep working until next March, mainly for financial reasons. She still has a senior. Her son, Lou, is going to mm-hmm. be a senior next year at Episcopal High. And they want to build up a nest egg to run him through college, just like they did Annie. And so it's gonna be tough, if nothing else, because of that. But
well,
the ALS is progressing so fast that it's almost intolerable.
She has been a splendid resource for this community, and has twice, 1992 and this year, mm-hmm. think about that, 26 years apart, been named the Communicator of the Year by the Public Relations Association of Louisiana. And within the last few days, she provided a commentary on receiving the Prowl Award for the second time. And here is Donna Britt commenting on winning this award for the second time, becoming the first person to ever do so.
Hi, it happened today. I got an award that I also got in 1992. I am the first person to win the Communicator of the Year Award from Public Relations Association of Louisiana. It's such an honor because these people are so eloquent and they're so good at communicating that while I was there, I said, look, some of you have got to come up with the next great idea after ice bucket challenges for ALS. And two people came to me after the ceremony and said, I'm on it, Donna. So I can't wait to see what's going to happen for our little quiet ALS association when PRAL gets all its friends together. And you know they're talented. You know they're brilliant and creative. They're the people who manage public relations accounts all over the state, with the state health department, with OLOL, with top corporations. It's a wonderful place to get, what do you call it, allies, you know? So I didn't have a picture to post. I don't know how I go to these things. Talk to all the people, hug them, and don't take a picture that I can have. But anyway, I want to let you know that I've won it again, and I'm very honored. And I hope that you have a great weekend, because I plan to. And we'll see you on the news at 6, okay? Love you guys. Bye.
And tonight will be the final newscast for Donna Britt. That was posted on Facebook. And George, you've been there. It's not easy to go away, is it?
No, good Lord, no. You find yourself looking around for things to do. And I had an outlet in that I could fly to Atlanta and record commercials for the first time in my life. But they were, you feel sort of like, pardon me if I use the word, whore, recording commercials after all those years of doing news and not doing commercials. And there's a lot of money in recording commercials. And I stopped doing that because my rabbi, who used to hire me for General Motors when I was in Detroit, got fired from the Coca-Cola account. And so the work wasn't there anymore. And now I just look around for things to do. You want somebody to record your church commercials? Here, just tell me when. I'll be right down.
But it's part of your identity. And I suspect there are people today who you see on the street who comment that they watch you every night on WAFB. They're probably unaware that you've gone away because you were such an institution there.
All the time, yeah. And the funny thing is little black kids, because, you know, African-Americans watch about twice or three times the TV that white folks watch. So you've got these little kids who still, their grandmothers made them watch Channel 9. And so they remember me.
Well, what about the chemistry that you and Donna had? As I noted, at times you were the top-rated duo in the country as far as, we're not talking about numbers of viewers, but we're talking about percentage.
Yeah.
And you were number one in the country for a while. And close to it the whole time you were together. What about the chemistry that was evident between the two of you?
That is a funny story. They put us together in August of 1988, 30 summers ago, and they had no idea this would happen, but we still don't know what it was, but this chemistry, as you call it, was so good that our consultant started requiring other stations in other markets to watch Donna and George in Baton Rouge. And I remember running into a guy named Dick Ford, who was the chief anchor at the NBC station in St. Louis. And I ran into him in New York when we were recording promos with, I don't know who it was, but I'd met him before, and he said, George, let me ask you something. Why is our consultant making me sit down and watch a pair of TV anchors from the 94th market in the country do tandem anchoring? I said, I don't know, man. I'm sorry. Well, the consultant says it works and it's the best chemistry in the country. And we don't know. We don't know why. Now, there's some funny stories that come from it, because at one point, Donna developed an allergy of some kind. Couldn't figure out what it was. She probably developed it because as she was getting older, we have a 16-year difference in our ages. That probably helped develop.
You're the older.
I'm the older. Oh, good God, yes. But all of a sudden, the station is getting all this revenue from these enormous ratings and this amazing chemistry, and they gave her skin tests. They put patches on her skin. They ran all sorts of tests. They couldn't find out what was wrong. And then they thought, oh, my God, she's allergic to George. The golden goose has been busted. Well, it turns out there was something, they were blocking the air conditioning system, and air was being recycled.
Wasn't your cologne?
No, I wasn't wearing cologne. Oh, man, I was staying neutral.
George Sells is with us to talk a few more minutes after we pause about the remarkable Donna Britt. Tonight, I'm sure there will be quite a farewell, and she can write well. I'm eager to see and hear what she has to say. 877-217-5757 is your number. 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. Talk at talklouisiana.org. And Donna Britt, who started right out of college at WAFB, hired by Carlton Cremines in the early 1980s, tonight is our last night, 6 o'clock news on WAFB. We're back after this pause for Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with George Sells, who spent 24 years as the co-anchor with Donna Britt on WAFB 6 and 10. Donna, 8 months ago, was diagnosed with ALS, and she has gallantly trudged forward for 8 months since October of last year, and tonight will be her last newscast on WAFB, and it will be a night to remember. She started there in 1981, right out of college, and is leaving in 2018. So from 8-1 to 1-8, 37 years, Donna Britt has been part of the family of Baton Rouge, and George Sells knows her about as well as anyone other than her husband, Mark Ballard, who's with us quite regularly.
Oh, I always refer to her as the second most important woman in my life after Sandy, my wife, who has since, of course, passed away. And she really was. And they had so much alike about them. Of course, Donna was more the intellectual type. But, I mean, it even goes down to breast cancer. My wife, Sandy, had breast cancer in situ, as they called it, which meant it was encapsulated and was not a bad thing. They were able to kill it with radiation. Then Donna develops it in the other breast in situ about a year later. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many duplicate things. But we did... Some people ask about the why we got along so great, and I think maybe it was the difference in age. There was never a risk of any romantic development, as there has been with a lot of other co-anchors. But I tell people, and I really mean this, I'm not making this up. I worked in the number four market as a TV anchor. I mean, I worked in New York, but I was not a TV anchor there. And many other large markets where I had very strong co-anchors and a couple of bimbos. But in all those markets, the best female co-anchor I ever had was in Baton Frigging Rouge, was Donna Britt. She was smart. She was pretty. She was kicky. She didn't take any bull. And one of the things also, she was one hell of a writer. And this is funny. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever, ever would say this to Donna. But when we were writing teases, I'm a real good tease writer. I mean, I'm really good. Well, she picked up my skill, and we would sort of have a contest on who was writing the best teases. And one time she wrote this fabulous tease, and I shouted across the desk to her. We sat real close to each other. I said, "You whore."
Oh, now, come on.
Yeah. But then she used to say the same thing to me when I wrote a good one.
She used to calm you down a little bit, too, when you'd get high strung. Anchor people tend to do that every now and then.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's called friendship.
Allie's nodding, yeah.
Friendship, yeah. They call it.
Well, before we go, I know you have a brief note that Dudley Lehue, a fine journalist in his own right, a man who broke the Chappaquiddick story many years ago and lived right here in Baton Rouge for several years, he wrote when he found out about Donna leaving.
He was not aware of, he had moved to the West Bank in New Orleans and was not aware that she had ALS. And I sent him a note, and I sent him a copy of the newspaper article on the front page of The Advocate. And he wrote this. Now, you got to remember that Dudley, not only breaking the Chappaquiddick story, but he sat on the national desk of the Associated Press at the time I happened to be working at ABC in New York. And he wrote this two-sentence thing. He said, "You and Donna and the WAFB news team were the source for accurate, unbiased, and professionally presented news, the same goals that drove me 20 years with the AP. Your pairing set a standard for TV news delivery that no longer exists. Dudley." I mean, that is just the ultimate compliment. I don't think it's true, but... thank you, Dudley.
He's a good man, and you're a good man, and Donna is better than just about anybody I've ever met. Truly a resilient person who's teaching us more about life and her capacity for it in the last few months than any way anybody could. She is a warrior, and tonight will be her last newscast at 6 o'clock on WAFB. Thank you, George Sells.
Thank you.
We're joined now by Dr. Adam Cox. He's a clinical psychologist. His work encompasses decades of psychotherapy with children and adolescents, and his book is Cracking the Boy Code. Earlier we talked with Frank Campbell, the suicidologist, and he noted that men and boys, they have 3.5 times the rate of suicide as do women. And this book is designed to, quote, learn the secret language of boys and how to reconnect. And boys can be hard to talk to and talk with. Dr. Cox, how do we crack the boy code? Okay, let's see if we can get Dr. Cox to a better place, because we're having some difficulty getting through to him. But this is, Allie, as you know, an important aspect of our life. And Frank Campbell was with us, and most prominently in the last week, we lost Anthony Bourdain, a person. And when some of these famous people take their lives, Kate Spade being another, a female, we suddenly wonder why and how somebody who is doing so well, seemingly, could take their life. But often, as in almost all cases, there's a story behind the story. And Dr. Cox has been involved in trying to find out why boys are particularly vulnerable to suicide and other disconnects from the world as we know it. And I think we've got him to a better spot now. I led into your book, Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys, and it's certainly a compelling title. And I asked you, Dr. Cox, how do we crack the boy code?
Well, there are two ways or two strategies that we need to use. And the first is that we have to make sure that we don't put the cart before the horse. And that's exactly what we're doing when we jump into talking to boys about serious topics. And I should note that usually we begin our conversations with boys talking about a worry, a concern, a problem, something that they're doing wrong. And, of course, they are already ready and defended against that possibility. So if we will slow ourselves down and use a tone, what I call in my book task tone, as a way of removing some of the emotionality from our voice, being more matter-of-fact, a little bit more directive, we do a much better job of talking to the part of the brain where boys make sense of the world. Secondly, we got to talk about things that are of interest to them, because we talk about almost nothing that is of interest to them. We're always talking about adult issues and concerns, and so we lose the opportunity to form meaningful relationships with kids because we are just off topic. We're talking about things. We repeat ourselves all the time, and that's a huge mistake.
You spend much of the book discussing how to motivate boys to become their authentic selves. How does this process begin?
Well, I think it begins with serious conversation. I think, you know, sometimes we as adults might perceive that we're having serious conversations with kids. But again, those serious conversations are almost always about an adult worry. You're not doing well enough in school. You're fighting too much with your brother. Your personal hygiene is a problem. These kinds of things that we say to young adolescent or older adolescent boys. But if we were to talk to them more in a way that we're actually curious about them, and we are helping them to define ways in which they are similar and different from their peers, then I think that we go a lot farther. I learned this traveling the world for 2 years, talking with boys between the ages of 9 and 18 in a bunch of different countries and continents, and I was struck by how important it is for boys to talk about their own individual differences. The most interesting topic in the world to boys is themselves. And so we ought to not be afraid to kind of steer the conversation toward those kinds of things. It's just that we need to kind of get the right tone going so that they don't become more anxious and feel more vulnerable in those conversations.
Dr. Cox, we have about a minute left, but how do we teach boys self-respect and confidence? As we know, men commit most of the crimes and have most of the bad things in the newspaper and on the radio and on television usually involve men. How do we teach boys at an early age to avoid the pratfalls that occur later in life?
I love your question, and I think that in 25 years of working with boys in a clinical setting, that the two most under-discussed topics with respect to boys is love and honor. And almost those concepts never come up in psychotherapy. We're afraid to talk with boys about love because we think that it's a prelude to talking about sex, and we just don't want to get into that with them. But we should bring up the concept of love and how you show love. We should understand that, as far as adolescent boys are concerned, that respect is the greatest expression of love that a parent can show. They already know that you love them the way that you, a parent loves a child, but do you respect them? And secondly, the concept of honor, because there's the kind of moral gravity that we need in boys' lives. And I think that we need to be very specific and illustrate ways that boys show honor in their lives. And when you talk to them about honor, they get so quiet, you could hear a pin drop, and it's a real winner of a topic.
The book is Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys, from Dr. Adam Cox. Thank you, Dr. Cox. Thanks for listening. Hiller Moore, the district attorney for East Baton Rouge, is with us tomorrow. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.